With the latest in agriculture news from across the state and the country, it's Farm City News Day. And here's your host, Sabrina Hill.
Good morning. Thanks for turning on the radio this morning for your agriculture news. Today is Tuesday, October 10th. Coming up in today's show, finding a balance between forage yield and quality. More on that in a moment, but first, Taylor Hillman gives us an update on California's HLB situation.
The California Department of Food and Agriculture added over 30 new cases of the deadly tree disease known as Huanglongbing disease last week. The Citrus Pest and Disease Prevention Program announced 33 new detections in the greater Los Angeles area, bringing the total number of HLB-infected tree detections in California to 199. One of those detections was in Riverside. That makes three total trees found in California's citrus's birthplace since the first detection back in July. CDFA said it's continuing to have an aggressive response to any detection, working quickly to treat host plants in the area, remove the sources of infection, place nursery stock on hold, and communicate with bulk citrus operations. Any tree that tests positive for the disease is removed, and CDFA reminds the industry this is not negotiable. None of the almost 200 HLB detections have been located in commercial productions. However, new finds are getting closer. Riverside County's quarantine does include some of the industry, including nurseries and UC Riverside. The general consensus of the industry is that HLB, also known as citrus greening, is more widespread in California than the confirmed reports. HLB has devastated Florida's citrus industry, cutting production back to a third of what it was 10 years ago. Currently, there is no cure for the disease. I'm Taylor Hillman for AgNet West Radio Network.
Mann Packing is removing its non-GMO label from select products because the company says it, quote, doesn't want to perpetuate a fear that something is wrong with GMOs. PR Week reports that the company is turning an about-face after getting some products verified under the non-GMO project. The company is removing the non-GMO verified check from its single-cut lettuce products in its next print run, that according to the company's director of corporate marketing. The company spokesperson says there is no GMO lettuce, so amid the company ask, why are we doing this? Mann sells other products that do not have the non-GMO verified check, but include copies stating they are GMO-free on the packaging. The company is discussing removing that label as well. Mann Packing was founded in Salinas in the 1930s. Today, the company is a majority woman-owned and operated business and says it's one of the country's leading suppliers of fresh vegetables. In other agriculture news, USDA's estimate for this year indicate U.S. pear production will decline for the fourth consecutive year. Rod Bain has more.
It's another decline in U.S. pear production. USDA economist Agnes Perez says, in fact,
the latest forecast for the 2017 U.S. pear crop is for it declining for a fourth consecutive year.
With this year's crop production estimated at over 1.4 billion pounds, a 4% decline year over year.
This year's production will be the smallest production reported since 1980, if realized.
While pear production increased in both California and Oregon, for the nation's largest pear-producing state,
Washington State's production is forecast to be down 20% from last year.
One tidbit of note, more pears, around two-thirds of this year's crop, is going to the fresh market, including Bartlett's, the main processed pear variety.
Bartlett pears are still going to the processing, but there's an increasing share of Bartlett's going to the fresh market.
And with the lower production forecast for pears,
this is pointing to likely stronger pear prices during the marketing season.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
The 2016 National Beef Quality Audit for cows and bulls results prove promising for the dairy industry. The 2016 report for cows and bulls follows the 2007 report and is funded by the Beef Checkoff. During the World Dairy Expo in Madison, Wisconsin, Dr. Keith Belk of Colorado State University explained the results.
The numbers of dairy cattle being marketed as a portion of the total consist of fed cattle has increased dramatically. It was about 5.3% of the population in 2011. It's now over 20% of the population. And so the numbers of dairy cattle contributing to the beef supply chain have grown dramatically. I mean, that's a big jump. As a consequence of that, improved the eating quality, the characteristics associated with eating quality satisfaction to consumers. For example, there's higher marbling scores, various other attributes that have improved.
He says the market cows and bulls marketed from the dairy industry have improved dramatically.
They're being marketed at a more appropriate time, and as a consequence, almost all characteristics that we see associated with that portion of the population have improved. We're very encouraged by how producers have begun to implement this concept of W. Edwards Deming of total quality management in the livestock production portions of the industry to address the things associated with animal handling and the things that have a consequence relative to product value downstream.
There are areas for improvement. He says traceability could give dairy an advantage over other sectors of the U.S. beef industry, as nearly every country except for the U.S. has traceability for consumers.
Those countries that are importing our beef products, they have an expectation of traceability. I'll use Japan as an example. A consumer can come up and using their cell phone, they can scan the barcode on any package of beef, and it'll immediately tell them who produced it, where it was born, what it was fed, what it was treated with, you name it. Well, they can't do that with U.S. beef. The dairy industry has an advantage here because they do have traceability. And so as we strive to grow our export markets and achieve those sorts of attributes, the dairy industry will be able to do that.
That's Dr. Keith Belk of the Colorado State University. This is Farm City News Day by AgNet West. I'm Sabrina Hill. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
The Citrus Research Board invites the citrus industry to attend this year's California Citrus Conference on Wednesday, October 11th in Visalia. Join the CRB at 7:30 for registration and a free breakfast. Sessions kick off at 9 with a focus on ACP control and HLB early detection technologies. California Ag Secretary Karen Ross will address attendees, followed by a free barbecue lunch. Afternoon sessions include post-harvest technologies, biocontrol, and the very latest in citrus breeding and varieties. Pre-register for this free conference online at citrusresearch.org.
Your local DuPont Pioneer team doesn't take with you from the word go lightly, especially when it comes to forages. Just ask your fellow producers, folks like Amos Smith.
We have an awesome support team from Pioneer. I think that they're probably one of the reasons why we are successful.
And Bruce Cullum.
They'll come out just anytime you want to call them and help us. You don't get that from all your other seed dealers, but these guys are here all season long.
As well as Ken Felt.
Just know that, you know, the research that Pioneer's done, it really, it shows, and the cows really do well with it, so we continue to use it.
Or Billy Rucker.
All in all, you know, seem like Pioneer is always in the top. I bleed green, and I bleed Pioneer.
Want a team that's with you from the word go? That's DuPont Pioneer. Ask them about leveraging the silage zone resource to produce the highest quality forages for your operation. Pioneer, with you from the word go.
The California Association of Food Banks Farm to Family Program helps growers and packers recoup costs for products that may otherwise go unused. The program takes secondary products or excess fruits and vegetables from the field to your local food bank and beyond. Many growers and packers receive reimbursement for picking and pack-out costs in addition to receiving a California state tax credit. Join the more than 100 growers and packers who already participate in Farm to Family. Visit cafoodbanks.org to learn more. That's cafoodbanks.org. Farm to Family. Good for families, good for farmers.
This is Farm City News Day. We'll have more of the day's agriculture news in just a moment. We'll be right back with more of the news that's important to you.
Okay, Mike is calling from Davenport. Go ahead, Mike. You're on Soil Talk.
The engine isn't performing like it should, and I'm wondering what's going on.
All right, a couple of questions, Mike. Do you have high porosity in aggregates? Is there a porous medium for gas exchange?
I don't know.
Well, hey, look, Mike, if you want performance, you got to find out if it's good under the hood, huh?
Okay, how?
Now stop by your local USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service office today, Mike. They can help you supercharge your soil and get that engine cranking it out for you.
Hey, we're out of time, Mike. Hey, thanks for your call. Gotta go. Thanks, everyone, for listening to Soil Talk.
Find out what you can do to maximize your farm's production engine. It's soil. Through soil health management systems, you can lower input costs, increase yields, and drought protect your farm. Stop by your local Natural Resources Conservation Service office today. Brought to you by NRCS and this radio station.
Welcome back to Farm City News Day by AgNet West. Here's Brian German.
Researchers with UC Cooperative Extension are seeing some interesting results testing quality and yield in forage crops. Goals of the research include finding an effective mineral balance of protein and fiber, along with improving intake potential. Statewide alfalfa and forage extension specialist Dan Putnam noted their progress in finding a beneficial program to optimize yield while maintaining quality.
Growers are continually having to compromise high yields to obtain high quality, or compromising quality to attain high yields. So we're always looking for that sweet spot in between, and yield is not the only thing you have to worry about. You have to worry about the forage quality as well. So we're continually trying to think through that, and part of the thought pattern here is that a delayed harvest with, say, the Harv Extra trait would increase the yields while maintaining quality at the same level as an earlier harvested crop.
I'm Brian German for Agnet West Radio Network.
Online sales of groceries are still a tiny percentage of total grocery sales. Why is that? Gary Crawford tells us.
Many retailers are creating or growing their online e-commerce systems, and consumers are using them. But in the grocery business,
there's not been a lot of inroads in terms of e-commerce into the grocery sector.
The National Retail Federation's Mark Matthews, and indeed at last count, grocery and beverage e-commerce sales only accounted for
less than a quarter percent of total sales at food and beverage stores.
Tiny. Agriculture Department research economist Abby Okrent. Why such small numbers? First, it's not easy or cheap for grocery stores to set up e-commerce systems. And she says some consumers have voiced concerns about spoilage of food ordered online, but also
food is sensory, you know? And so when you do it online, it takes away all that touch, feel, smell of the food.
Also, stores have added things like restaurants, cooking demos, food and beverage tastings to attract people into the stores, and it seems to be working. One survey says 86% of consumers still buy most of their groceries in stores. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Washington.
Well, in today's livestock news, a big livestock event took place last weekend in the EU. Agnet Media's Gary Cooper was there and has this report.
Here at the Summit de l'Élevage in Clermont-Ferrand, France, Summit, industry, and local officials announcing a big new expansion of show facilities to break ground soon. The 25 million euro investment to build a major new exhibition hall and infrastructure for more inside exhibitors as this already huge event continues to grow. The show is also expected to expand to four full days, adding a day to what is now a three-day run to better handle the expanding crowds and allow more time for the dozens of countries involved here to discuss and secure import and export arrangements that are negotiated here at this livestock summit. As a farm news journalist now going on 40 years in the business in the U.S., and considering all the clamor among U.S. farmers and ranchers about the growing importance of international trade, it's a bit disappointing to realize that Americans aren't even aware of this event, or if they are, have never attended it. That changed at this year's 26th annual Summit de l'Élevage, as the Livestock Export Association of the U.S. joined the 1,800 or so other exhibitors and planted the seeds of interest in what's going on here. Upwards of 90,000 visitors are expected to have been here once final numbers are tallied soon. And considering the dozens of countries here looking to do trade deals while they're here, that sounds like a pretty good bang for the bucks involved to me. From South Central France, for Agnet Media, I'm Gary Cooper.
Thanks, Gary. And now that U.S. producers have established their presence at that event, they're now talking potential beef trade with the EU. During that 26th annual event that wrapped up this past weekend, Gary Cooper talked with Catherine J. Lanella, General Director for Economic and Environmental Performance of Enterprises in France.
I would be interested to know if there's been any progress in protocol establishment for live cattle trade between our countries and what Americans might do to further that effort.
Okay. So we've been working on that, and I don't know whether we can say we've made progress, but for sure we are working hard. Work is in progress. Anything that can be done, well, we need to continue the discussion. We are open to have more U.S. beef on our market, but we are also open to export more EU beef, and in particular French beef, to the U.S. market.
I think there's a market both ways, it sounds to me like. Is there anything that we can do to help the effort and push it along, or what's the holdup maybe?
I'm not sure I have the answer to that question. So I think that every party is making its best effort at the moment. So, well, I'm confident that we can find solutions that are good for your farmers in the U.S. and our farmers in the EU.
It has to be two-way.
Yes, for sure, and a win-win agreement.
Win-win. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Again, that was Agnet Media's Gary Cooper talking with Catherine J. Lanella during the recent Summit des Élevages in France. I'm Randall Wiseman for Agnet West. AgriView with Evergreiner is next.
Now, it's not a common subject that everybody discusses every day, but family food security is high on the list to a lot of people. Right now, the cost of energy is of much more concern to these groups. See, the cost of energy, like gas, natural gas, all types of energy, cause food volumes to fall. As it happens, low-income families have less money to spend on food. I don't have to tell you the results of this, but less food leads to a host of problems, none of which is good. Some families skip meals. Some cut the size of their meals. All this leads to what is known as food distress. Doesn't bother most people, but there are people who care, and there's an effort to change it. Nobody in America should go hungry. Don't you agree? That's AgriView for today. Everett Griner, Agnet West.
Taylor Hillman has today's interview segment. Here's Taylor.
Carlos Suarez. I'm the state conservationist, state director for USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service in California.
Carlos, you're getting ready to head out of the United States. What's going on?
Yeah, we're going to a team of 17 technical staff from NRCS from across the nation are getting ready to leave in a few days to the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico, the U.S. territory of Puerto Rico. As all of us know, there was Hurricane Maria that impacted Puerto Rico two weeks ago, actually specifically on September 20th. So a team that have specialties, including engineers, soil scientists, soil conservationists, agronomists, and with experience in this type of emergency watershed protection work, we'll be heading to Puerto Rico for a minimum of 3 weeks. 3 to 4 weeks is what we're expecting to assess the damages caused by Hurricane Maria, specifically as it relates to soil erosion, debris removal, or debris that are blocking canals and rivers, and potential for more mudslides that may cause or they pose a threat to life and property.
So what's the goal for you guys here in your time there? You talked about several projects you guys will be looking at, but what's your goal there? Is to use some of your guys' programs to stabilize things a little bit?
Yes, our goal is first and foremost identify what we call exigency sites. And exigency are those sites that pose a threat to life and property. And our goal is to identify those sites and get an inventory of those sites in the island, the ones that have the highest priority to be addressed. And this is done in coordination with the Puerto Rico Department of Natural Resources, the Puerto Rico Department of Agriculture, and also with the municipalities of the island. And this is, again, under the auspice of the Emergency Watershed Protection Program. Also, we want to identify places where some of our conservation programs like EQIP, the Environmental Quality Incentive Program, can be utilized to stabilize, say, we know that there are several farms or dairies where they have lost livestock and animals have died and have to be disposed properly. So it's going to be a combination of using EWP and EQIP, those programs, to provide assistance.
So I understand there's two representatives from California, yourself and then an engineer here in California, NRCS.
Taylor. Actually, we have four representatives. The group went up to four. So we have myself as the state director, and we have three engineers that are representing us as well.
Great. For yourself, and you and I just talked about this a little bit, I asked you if you were prepared for what you were going to see. This is a little personal for you, correct?
It is. I am born and raised in Puerto Rico. I came to the mainland when I was 25 to start working for NRCS, and that's the only agency that I know my whole career. And going to Puerto Rico, although I have experience in other type of disasters like Hurricane Mitch in Central America, where I was stationed for 2 years in Nicaragua working for the U.S. Embassy, this one is personal from the standpoint that that's where I grew up. And no matter how professional I am or the skills that I have, I know it's going to hit me emotionally because, as a friend said to me, it's going to feel like if you were a doctor, it's going to feel like you're performing surgery on your own mother. So, but I'm ready. Most of the group are actually from Puerto Rico. We have talked about this and we are ready. We're professionals. We have the skills. I know it's going to be emotional, but we're ready for the challenge.
Well, good luck, Carlos. Thanks for taking some time with us before you leave. And, you know, I'm sure California is happy. We've got some representatives going over there too. So, thanks again and good luck.
Thank you, Taylor. Thanks for the chance to talk to your audience. Take care.
This is Farm City News Day by AgNet West. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
The Citrus Research Board invites the citrus industry to attend this year's California Citrus Conference on Wednesday, October 11th in Visalia. Join the CRB at 7:30 for registration and a free breakfast. Sessions kick off at 9 with a focus on ACP control and HLB early detection technologies. California Ag Secretary Karen Ross will address attendees, followed by a free barbecue lunch. Afternoon sessions include post-harvest technologies, biocontrol, and the very latest in citrus breeding and varieties. Pre-register for this free conference online at citrusresearch.org.
Your local DuPont Pioneer team doesn't take with you from the word go lightly, especially when it comes to forages. Just ask your fellow producers, folks like Amos Smith.
We have an awesome support team from Pioneer. I think that they're probably one of the reasons why we are successful.
And Bruce Cullum.
They'll come out just anytime you want to call them and help us. You don't get that from all your other seed dealers, but these guys are here all season long.
As well as Ken Felt.
Just know that, you know, the research that Pioneer's done, it really, it shows, and the cows really do well with it, so we continue to use it.
Or Billy Rucker.
All in all, you know, seem like Pioneer is always in the top. I bleed green, and I bleed Pioneer.
Want a team that's with you from the word go? That's DuPont Pioneer. Ask them about leveraging the silage zone resource to produce the highest quality forages for your operation. Pioneer, with you from the word go.
AgNet West Radio Network.
The House Budget Committee has voted 22-14 along party lines.
Your trusted agriculture news provider for the state of California. AgNet West's team of Sabrina Hill.
As crews continue to fight the Detweiler fire in Mariposa County.
Brian German.
Weedy rice has been a growing concern for California farmers.
And myself, Taylor Hillman. Join us every day to stay up to date with the latest agriculture news from AgNet West Radio Network and online at agnetwest.com.
You're going to need me.
You're going to need us.
All of us.
You're going to need our technical skills.
Our math. Our engineering skills.
You're going to need our help with your water. Your air. Your food.
You're going to need our organizational skills. Our problem-solving skills.
You're going to need our determination, our honesty, our compassion.
You're going to need the next generation of leaders to face the challenges the future will bring.
And we promise, we'll be there when you need us.
Today, 4-H is growing the next generation of leaders. Support us at 4-H.org.
Your Beef Checkoff does all kinds of things to help make sure consumers feel good about buying beef, like researching the health benefits of beef and sharing this news with healthcare professionals, or discovering new lean cuts of beef like the Denver cut steak, which fits an active lifestyle, or sharing the good news about these new beef products and cuts with chefs, grocers, and consumers. Get to know your checkoff and start sharing your views at mybeefcheckoff.com. Paid for by the Beef Checkoff.
Welcome back to Farm City News Day by AgNet West. Now more of the agriculture stories you'll want to know today. Dairy producers work hard every day to supply a product that countless consumers rely on for the foundation of their diet. Darren Wilhite has more.
Nutritious and affordable, dairy products are a staple worldwide. Registered Holstein breeder Tim Kellercrest of Wisconsin says consumers can have great confidence in the milk and dairy products supplied by U.S. dairy producers.
The most important thing for us is taking care of our cattle. I know there's these stereotypes you get out there and things like that. People hear things, they read things, they see things on the internet, and that's just not right. It's not true. Cow comfort is so important.
Opening the door for conversation between dairy producers and consumers can help combat negative perceptions surrounding modern agricultural practices. Communications expert Michelle Ruby, owner of Ruby Dew Incorporated, Portland, Oregon, shares this advice.
I think the most important thing when someone puts you on the defense immediately is how do you play offense? How do you turn that around? And so the one key communication tip I always give anyone is never repeat the negative. So no matter what topic or what issue they're addressing, know that you're in control of your own destiny, how you respond to that question, how you respond to that individual is entirely up to you.
Ruby adds that registered Holstein breeders can have an advantage when it comes to telling the dairy industry story, breeding Holsteins through generations of excellent cow families.
I think one of the key things is just doing what you do well and doing it consistently. And Holstein breeders over time have continued to breed a cow that's efficient and certainly will stand the test of time. And I think if we can use some of that in our storytelling, it certainly doesn't hurt.
For more information on the Holstein Association, visit HolsteinUSA.com. I'm Darren Wilhite.
What really happens in a trade negotiation? Michael Clements looks into it.
Trade is a vital component to the success of U.S. agriculture. Canada and Mexico, members of the North American Free Trade Agreement, along with the United States, are top destinations for U.S. farm products. With NAFTA entering renegotiations, Part 3 of the U.S. Grains Council's Trade Focus series explains what happens during a trade negotiation. Floyd Gabler is the Director of Trade Policy and Biotechnology for the U.S. Grains Council. Prior to joining the council, Gabler served as Deputy Undersecretary for Farm and Foreign Agricultural Services at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. He has more than 25 years of experience in trade policy. Gabler explains how trade negotiations work.
The parties that are involved in negotiation, really the first thing they have to do is sit down and agree on what the parameters, what areas they want to cover, the scope of those areas, how far are they willing to get into each of those areas. Then they put a process in place. There are goals to try and have these things done, obviously, as soon as possible, but in most cases, these are years-long processes. It is always a tough thing to get through because everybody has the same vested interests of trying to benefit their citizens and commerce of their respective countries.
Oftentimes, we hear trade negotiators are at the table, but what does that really mean?
What the term, you know, really implies is that they'll have different chapters that they'll be negotiating individually, and there will be specialists and experts in those areas. They will raise issues that they want discussed. At some point, they'll put text of proposals down on the table. That's the reference they use. They table these texts, and then they let the other parties react to them. But it is a process of discussion to try and narrow differences.
For the United States, there is a process which new ideas can be brought up during a trade negotiation. Through that process, farmers and farm groups can provide input.
In the U.S., we have a very accessible process to do that. It takes several forms, but the most official and used one is through the U.S. Federal Register. Notices are put out asking for formal comments by citizens, either as individuals or as organizations, to provide comments. And then when they actually have the negotiations, they do have opportunities for cleared advisors to actually meet with negotiators. And there are also opportunities to have sort of ad hoc meetings with others.
Trade negotiations take time, and no two negotiations are the same. He explains how negotiators make decisions and reach agreements.
There is never a set timeline. I think when they do enter these negotiations, they do reach a general agreement on a timeline that they think is politically and practically doable. And it's usually a multi-year process. It's just, again, the nature of these negotiations. They take time. They have these negotiating sessions. They reach some agreements. New things are discussed, and they have to go back and refine and recalibrate. Good things take time, and you have to work hard for them.
In part four of the Trade Focus series, we'll learn more about how trade and market development are connected. Learn more about the importance of trade online at www.grains.org. Michael Clements reporting.
Data collection has wrapped up for USDA's upcoming crop production report. Gary Crawford has more.
The next USDA forecast for this season's crop production is coming out shortly, October 12th.
Folks are eagerly awaiting the updated forecast to see has anything changed since last month.
Lance Honig with USDA's Statistics Service. That answer we don't have, but we will have shortly. All the result of a massive data collection effort that started the last week of September. USDA surveying thousands of farmers for their take on what their yields will be. And USDA experts have been out evaluating field plots, the same ones they checked for the September crop report.
Nearly 5,000 plots for corn, cotton, and soybeans, 1,920 samples for corn, 1,835 for soybeans, 1,197 for cotton. And for each of those sample counts I just gave you, we lay out two units within that field. So you really can double those counts in terms of how many plots we're visiting month after month.
Enumerators have been taking measurements of crops on those plots, also sending crop samples to the USDA lab in St. Louis for analysis. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Washington.
For more on any of the stories you've heard here this morning, visit our website at agnetwest.com. You can also find us on Twitter at agnetwest or myself at Sabrina W. Hill. This has been Farm City News Day by Agnet West, and I am your host, Sabrina Hill. Have a wonderful day.